The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, how are you? Good. Thank you for coming out on one of these very warm days. It's so great, isn't it, after all that snow and rain. It is an honor for me to be here tonight to introduce not only a great, great writer, but also a dear, dear friend, someone who has done so very much in terms of world literature and African literature. So it is just quite a night for me to be here. I want to begin by saying to you that I first brought Gugiwa Thiong'o to a place called Temple University in the 1980s when I was still teaching there. He came to the graduate program to teach this thing called the novel and writing, and it was an honor to have him there in that department. When he was there, he made two speeches during that time and on campus. And I was saying to Googie backstage that I had introduced him twice, and so I brought those two introductions tonight, and then I will do one that is a 2010 introduction. Introduction, Gugiwa Thiong'o at Temple University 1. At night, the noises of Kenya rise. Cries of children and workers, politicians and workers, patriots and workers, the incessant lights of American military bases bleaching like lost stars in the night, and the country, loud with corruption, continues to hide behind international conferences for women. And in the prisons and villages and cities, poets and professors dream of freedom, and their dreams and hopes silhouetted against a country with skeletons coming out of its head whisper, "We are coming, eating a little earth. We are coming to stop the imperialist incessant dawns. Googie has eaten a little of this earth, and yes, we all have to eat a little earth before we die. And we who come from the earth will finally taste of ourselves this earth, which will seep from the corners of our mouths and make us whole." Two. As I read Googie now, it seems as if his words have taken on more flesh and are more human. They have become larger. His men, women, moving, stumbling, resisting, plunging into everything that is delicate. And through his words, through this Kenyan man, black and still with sun, eyes in spreading solitude, and through this Kenyan man in exile from his country, we situate him in closer contact with the Philippines, Nicaragua, Cuba, the world. Like Jose Marti, he is a writer and patriot. He writes of his landscape and believes, as Volta and others, that good is apparently destroyed by others, but they do not destroy it completely as evil destroys itself. As I read Gugiwa Thiong'o, my eyes put on more flesh, and I taste the world. There is no turning back. And we were laughing in the back about being at a conference in England, in London, with a man by the name of C.L.R. James, and they had asked us to prepare papers. So, I went first with my paper, and people were very, 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 appreciative. And then Googie went with his paper, and people were more and more appreciative. And then C.L.R. James was looking at us, and then he just leaned back on his eyes and began to talk. And Googie and I said, "It is so good being around masters, is it not? If you have not ever read C.L.R. James, you should read Black Jacobins, because at some point that is one of the most important books of the 20th century. Indichia, 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 you man close to the ancestors. In the 1980s, I brought Gugi Wathiongo to Temple University to teach in the graduate writing department. He gave two lectures, readings during his tenure at Temple, and I introduced him twice during that time. It was a great honor to introduce him. How to speak to you of Gugi Wathiongo, how to write words so that you can breathe his beauty, so you can taste his spirit, so you can hear his integrity and intellect, so you can understand the influence he has had on generations of African, of men and women. I would begin by saying that Gugi Wathiongo is ancient. He was there when the winds were born. He comes from the east and the west. He has entered into the living with all people. Who would refuse to be born when they hear Gugi Wathiongo's voice? His essays and novels teach us how to remain human. They resonate with beauty of the human spirit. They tell us about an Africa that suffers from Europhonism, the replacement of native names and language systems with European ones. Gugi writes about a revitalization of Africa, saying that a renaissance of African languages is a necessary step in the restoration of African wholeness. And we begin to understand that by doing this, the continent will hold itself up against death, silence, destruction, and a constant loss of social memory. How to write an introduction about a man who listens to the wings of butterflies, whose words gave my eyes memory, who listens to trees drenched in perfect silence, who is heavy with the documentation of our bones, whose intellect kisses our eyes. I will merely say he is a man who walks on rivers, a man who measured his steps from James Ngugi to Gugi Wathiongo, a man who made us travel so far towards the east that we met ourselves all over again. Thank you, my dear brother, for carrying the signature of African men and women in your veins. As we read your brilliant memoir, Dreams in a Time of War, thank you for showing us in your conversation with your father at the end of the book that the most seditious thing we can do in the world is to do the best we can do, and not to be a prisoner of anger or rage or resentment. Thank you for teaching me and our children that most important lesson. And I give you Gugi Wathiongo.
Thank you, Sonia. Sonia and I have known each other for a little while. I think 30 years. Anyway, at least we met in 1971 under very dramatic circumstances. When she came to Fred Cutty's house, who was blind, a mutual friend, and I think she had finished reciting her poem, but he called her back to the house. I can't remember the sequence of what went before, but she came to his house and recited her poetry to me, so I met her under those circumstances. In one of her birthday celebrations, I was in here in Philadelphia, I think, I once talked about her being a lioness, you know, sort of roaring everywhere and so on. And I see that in her latest book, Maya Angelou described her as a lion in the forest. So we really agreed that she is. but more important for me, she has, in the poem or I wrote for her during that birthday, I talked about her appearing to me in different forms, in different places. And one of the places she appeared to me was when I was in a maximum security prison in Kenya because of my work in theater. That was 1977. It happened that at our meeting, our first meeting in New York, she gave me a poster with one of her poems, okay? And that poster, I put in my library in my home in Kenya. When the police came for me, that poster was actually hanging on the wall. So they picked books and so on. You see, this poster was, as Sonia Sanchez was watching their every step or their every act and so on. And this is the image I went with, you know, in prison, thinking about it all the time. When I came out of prison, I found that my two youngest children, you know, one of whom was born here in America. I think he may have been with us when when we first met. He and the girl grew up watching this poster, and they knew the poem so well because they had recited it over and over and over again the year that I was away. So we keep on meeting in several places, and we continue meeting in different forms, in different places. And thank you very much for the words you have said. Yeah. Now, I want to go straight into the reading. I've never written an autobiography before. I've always avoided it. You know, I've been asked before, why don't you write about it? And I say, what can I say about myself? And so on. But eventually, my wife, Jerry, who is not here, told me, you know, you have to do it for your children, but more important, for your grandchildren. They must know what you went through. And what I wanted to convey to them, these grandchildren, was the idea of following one's dream, you know, aiming for the stars, if you like, and never giving up your dream, no matter how adverse the circumstances are, whether they are personal or social, political or whatever, that you must cling to your dream no matter what happens. And that if you fall, you must rise again and again and again. So if there's any theme that I would like to my children to know, is that one of persistence, you know, sort of, you know, never giving up their dreams and so on. Now, the person who really impresses upon me through her actions was my mother. Okay? And the piece I want to start with is the question of polygamy. I was in England recently, and it happened that Zuma from South Africa was also there to see a queen, and he was being asked by the British press, you know, about polygamy and so on. So naturally, when I went there for my book tour, the first question was, well, in your book, you say you come from a polygamous family, and what do you think about polygamy? Okay, so I found myself having to talk about it, but I should have done something which I'm going to do today. That is, read my mother's answer to the same question. Because when we were growing up, I asked her, you know, why did you get into, how did you come to be the third wife of my father's four wives? You know, and this is because all my sisters and everybody else were very opposed to polygamy. So I used to hear them swearing that they would never marry into a polygamous, you know, household. So one night I asked her, why did you consent to polygamy? Why did you accept being the third wife of my father, who already has older children? It was because of his two first wives, Wangari and Gachoki, and their children, she said, with light and shadows from the wood fire playing on her face. They were always together, such harmony. And I often wondered how it would feel to be in their company. And your father, he was not to be denied. I don't know how he knew where I worked in my father's fields, well, your grandfather's, but he would somehow appear, just smile and say a few words. Like, what a pity you such a hard-working beauty should ever team up with a lazy man, he would tease me. Those were no small words coming from a man who had so many goats and cows, and he had acquired all that wealth by his own toil. But I did not want him to think that I would simply fall for his words and reputation, and I challenged him. How do I know that you are not one of those who work their wives to death and then claim the wealth came from his hands alone? The following day, he came back, a hole on his shoulder, as if to prove that he did not include himself among the lazy. Without waiting for my invitation even, he started to work. It became a playful but serious competition to see who would tire first. I held my own, she said with a touch of pride in her prowess. The only break was when I lit a fire and roasted some potatoes. Hey, don't you think you and I should combine our strength in a home? He again asked. I said, just because of one day's work on a field already broken? Another day, he found me tired trying to clear some bush to expand my farm. He joined in the clearing, and by the end of the day, we were both exhausted, but neither of us would admit to it. He went away, and I thought he would never appear again. But he did come back on another day, without a hole, an enigma of a smile on his face. Oh, yes, she says, such a day it was. The crop was in bloom, the entire field covered with pea flowers of different colors. And I always remember the butterflies, so many, and I was not afraid of the bees that competed with the butterflies. He took out a bead necklace and said, will you wear this for me? Well, I did not say yes or no, but I took it and wore it, she said with an inaudible sigh. My mother would not, however, answer follow-up questions, but what she had said was enough to tell me how she became the third of my father's wives, but not sufficient to tell me how she came to lose her place as the youngest and latest to Jerry, the fourth wife, or even how she felt about the new addition to the family. Now, when, as I said, I grew up in a large family, you know, and it's not all pretty, you know, it was nice to have, it's nice to grow in a huge family, it's nice, wonderful, but it's not pretty. But what really concerns me here in my tobacco is how things that happen in simply far away could still impact our lives. Okay? And I want to talk a little bit about the effect of the Second World War on our rural village. It happened that some of my brothers, or one of my half-brothers was in the war. He was one of the, what we call the king's men, because they fought for the British, who went about singing, Tuafunga safari, Tuafunga safari, Amri ya nani abwana tufunga safari. We are marching on, at whose order? the king's orders. Let's march on. Kafai, that's by her brother, was not the only one from our extended family who fought in the Second World War. Another one, cousin Mwangi, the eldest son of my uncle, had joined. Names of strange people, Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, Stalin, and Roosevelt, and places like America, Germany, Italy, Russia, Japan, Madagascar, and Burma occasionally cropped up in the story sessions in Wangari's fireside. That's my elder mother's place where we all gather to hear stories. These names and places were vague in outline, you know, kind of shadows in a mist. Especially Hitler. Was this Hitler, for instance, the same who had refused to shake hands with Jesse Owens? I could understand them only in terms of scary ogres versus heroes in the never-never land of orality. Hitler and Mussolini, who threatened to enslave Africans, were the bad, ugly ogres, and so on. But pitted against this beast, that's Hitler and Mussolini, and its deadly intentions, were brave characters, part of the British army of saviors, and among them were cousin Mwangi and brother Kafai. We heard of their exploits in Abyssinia, in the campaign against Mussolini's Italy and East Africa, and a lot of new names and places such as Addis Ababa, Eritrea, Mogadishu, Italian and British Somaliland entered into the conversation at the fireside storytelling sessions. Of course, the complexities of warfare eluded me. Bits and pieces of the stories really coalesced into whispers of Mussolini's soldiers' surrender. To me, it was quite simple. Heroes had defeated ogres, at least those marching towards us, and our brother and our cousin had played a part in the victory. In my mind, Joseph Kafai, my half-brother, whom I had not met, was the most heroic, and Mussolini's soldiers had really surrendered to him. He and I were connected with by blood, our fathers, and so I had a small part in the surrender. But memories of war were not just through stories. They were all around us, actually, because in Kenya, when I was born in 1938, under the shadow of the Second World War. And so as I grew up, you know, we could see military convoys, you know, passing through our area and so on. And at one time, in fact, you know, some of the military convoys had an accident near our place. And we ran there, and it was a terrible sight to see. I always remember that, you know. And for a time, we thought that our brother was actually among the dead. But one night, he came home in an army truck, two headlights splitting the darkness. There was not much of a road to our homestead. The truck simply made two tracks past Lord Kahahu's orchard, that's our landlord, to our compound. Unfortunately, it had been raining. The truck got stuck in the mud. And as the driver tried to rev it out, the truck hit my mother's heart and dug deeper in the mud. The army men in green khaki fatigues and army hats spent most of their night visit trying to dig it out, using flashlights to see. We crowded around them, and I could not even make out who Kafai was, except when he, a shadowy figure among shadowy figures, left his men digging and said a hurried greetings to the family. He was back from the East African campaign, resting and recharging Nairobi before redeployment to other fronts in Madagascar and Burma. By the time they dug out the truck, They could only eat hurriedly and were anxious to leave and return to camp in Nairobi. So we did not spend much time with him, but I hardly slept thinking of the drama that had just ended. It was as if Kafai, my brother, had jumped out of a story, said a hello and a goodbye, and then jumped back into the story. Hitting my mother's heart and digging out the truck at night was not exactly the most heroic homecoming for one who had been all over the world fighting ogres, but then his was the first motor vehicle ever to come to our homestead. The visit, however, was forever engraved in my mind, and talks of the big war now brought back memories of a military truck stuck in the mud by my mother's heart. Now, I don't know how long it was after Kafai's visit, but more magical happens followed. A white man, a really white man, came to our homestead. Although white people owned the tea plantations on the other side of the rail and had even heard that there were white owners of the Limuru Batashu factory, the nearest thing to a white man I had seen at close quarters were the Indian shopkeepers. But here was a real white man on foot in our homestead. And we ran by his side, calling out, "Modogo, Modogo," as a white man, white man. He said something like, "Bon" or "Buena," and then he asked for eggs. My mother gave him some, even refusing his money in exchange. And he uttered something like "Gracia" or "Grazia," and went away saying "Ciao," which we took for yet another word for "thank you." We followed behind him, a crowd of children still calling out, "Modogo, Modogo," in "white man, white man." And then came the shock. We saw white men making a road. White men who were not supervising blacks, but were actually breaking the stones themselves. Later, more of these workmen came to our place asking for eggs. My eye throwing words like "Buonasera," "Buongiorno," "Pronto," "Grazia." But the word that was most frequent and common to all of them, the one that lingered in the mind, was "Bono." So we nicked them. We called them "Bono." I later learned that they were Italian prisoners of war, taken between May and November 1941, when the Italians surrendered at Ambalage and Goda, ending the East African campaign. And of course, a time came when I longer saw the Bono Mayai in any of our villages walking about or asking for eggs. But the Bonos, even though they had disappeared, left their architectural mark in a church they had built by the road on the edge of the Rift Valley in their hours of rest, and also their socio-biological mark in broken families and fatherless brown babies born in several of the villages they had visited. So Italian prisoners of war. Now, I said I was born in 1938, the shadow of the Second World War. And this book is also about my education, the struggle for school. And schools that I went to were independent schools in Kenya, run by Africans, as against the other schools then run by missionaries or the colonial government. Now, what I found later, that these schools, which were independent, had actually a connection with America, I did not know because they were independent. I'll tell you the connection because it's very interesting. You find some of it here, but just let me just tell you. What happened was this. Marcus Garvey. Okay. Oh, you know him. Good. You see, Marcus Garvey, you remember from Jamaica, came over here. And you remember his come here was really to meet Booker T. Washington because he had heard of Tuskegee Institute and what really impressed upon him was the idea of self-reliance. Remember, not all the other social visions, but the idea of self-reliance, okay? When he came over here, you know, of course, he found the biggest movement of black people anywhere in history, okay? Now, his paper or magazine called The Negro World or, you know, used to be smuggled. I mean, literally, it spread here, it spread in Europe, but also in Africa. And in Africa, the journal was hounded, literally, by all the colonial governments, you know. So that was magazine must have reached Kenya as well, you know. Now, the idea of self-reliance, that we can do this ourselves, was actually the idea that most stuck in the people's minds. And remember that in a colonial context, where you're supposed to be a baby or things done for you, that kind of thing, the idea that we can do things for ourselves. So self-reliance translated into independence. Okay. So independence and the idea of independence became very, very, very important. In fact, initially, the colonial government would not even register an independent school because they didn't like the word independent. Okay? Yeah. So the school which I went to actually was part of that whole phenomenon. I've talked about it here. And by the way, these schools were the ones which were later banned by the colonial regime after the break out of Mau Mau armed struggle against the British colonial state. Now, these Mau Mau, as you learn from this also, my brothers were, some were fighting in the mountains, like my own biological brother was a guerrilla fighter in the mountains. But there are others, or at least one of them, who was actually fighting on the side of the British. So our family was kind of, you know, split, as happened in so many, when it's so many crises, okay? Now, so Mau Mau, Mau Mau also dominated my coming of age, going to school. So I'm going to remember, I was born at the shadow of the Second World War, and I'm going through school during the Mau Mau, you know, war itself. So death was all around us. Now, but in the evenings, people still whispered, okay? And I remember this very clearly. There was a kind of village storyteller, or griot, if you like, you know, who always told me stories. His name is Gadi, and he's the one who always interpreted the world outside through some stories. He seemed to know everything. And where he did not know, I think he made up. But that's okay. Yeah. So I once asked him about the rumors that I had heard that black Americans and black South Africans would come to help us. South Africans and black Americans have their own struggles, he said. But they are sympathetic to our plight, Gadi tells me. His name is Gadi. For instance, Bishop Alexander from South Africa was here, a guest of the independent schools between 1935 and 1937 to help ordain clergy of the Orthodox faith. And he mentioned a couple of people who were turning to Orthodox bishops by Alexander. He mentions Marcus Garvey, whose journal, Negro World, somehow reached the liberation movement leaders in the 1920s. And after the Kenya settlers and the colonial state massacred those demanding the release of Harry Thuku in 1922, because Marcus Garvey was in touch with Harry Thuku, the Kenyatta of those days, Marcus Garvey himself called a huge rally at Liberty Hall in New York, and on their behalf sent a telegram to Lloyd George of Britain and prophesied that in 30 years, Kenyans would wage armed struggle against the British. And it came to be exactly 30 years from that statement, by the way. Marcus Garvey was a prophet, Garvey said, because what he said has come to be. And then Garvey cites the friendship of Kenyatta with Powell Robeson, George Padmore, and W.E.B. Du Bois, and the 1945 Pan-African Congress in Manchester. He also mentioned another man, Ralph Bunche, a big man in the United Nations, and he said that he was Chief Koinange's friend. And remember, Bio was Kenyatta's lieutenant, was educated in America, and he must have made many friends. But the soldiers who came to Kenya Teachers College at the Githurai Ogun in 1944 and sang Negro spirituals may have been behind the talk of black Americans coming to help us fight the British. Now, why would this have been very important? Because these black American soldiers, some were stationed in Nairobi, also came to Githunguri Teachers College, which figures here, and this is one of the colleges built under the inspiration of Bill Koinange, who was also a student at, who came to school here, and he went back and tried to build a teacher's college by Africans, built on a Tuskegee model. This is a picture which he had. So the good teacher's college was very, very important, And so when black American soldiers stationed in Nairobi were there, Bill invited them to Kenya Teacher's College, where they sang Negro spirituals. Very important, yeah. Now, I want to read probably the last piece, which is very personal to me. And I will explain why. You'll see it. This is also in honor of my sister, who died, I think, at the beginning of this year. Her name is Joki. What happened was this. My friend and I were walking one Sunday. We'd done our sort of elementary school education. We'd had done the final exam. And for us, every exam was always terminal. Where to go to. So if you failed, you stopped there. You didn't go. There were no other venues for education. So all exams were very, very, very important. And even then, it was like a pyramid. There is also a paramedical, only a few would actually go through, And so one day, he and I, we finished our exams. We are coming from church, open air, kind of Christian gathering and so on. And then we go home. We pass through a forest path to back to our home. And there, out of the blue, comes British soldiers in their fatigues and so on. They were hiding in the forest, And we find that actually there was a kind of what they were stopping people and arresting some, so we also stopped. Now, with my little English, I tried to explain things, but I did not say the word. I kept on forgetting to say the word afande. For some reason, this became very important, like saying boss, I suppose, or saying master, or, master, or whatever, afande, So every time I said afande, so at one time he thought I was being defiant, and he hit me, and then he hit me again and again, and I just gone through initiation, and once you go through initiation in our community, you're a man, you're supposed not to cry. So here I am, I'm a man in my view, then I can't fight back and I cannot cry, but I'm full of rage, as it were. But anyway, then we continue with my friend after I'm released. And instead of going home, there's tension between us because he was not stopped. and I was stopped and beaten. Okay? So we don't really talk about that incident. You know, but after some silence, we decided to go by our school just to see whether you can hear something about the results, okay, of our exams. And we go there, and the same day, I'm told, you have been accepted at one of the most elitist of high schools in Kenya at the time, Alliance High School. So I don't know how to take the day with its extreme of downs and ups. The news does not sink in. I don't know how to enjoy it. But when I go home and say that I have passed the Kenya African Preliminary Examination and have been accepted at Alliance High School, my mother has only one question. Is that the best? This is a question she always asks. Even when I, by the way, even when I got 10 out of 10, and then she always asked me whether that was really the best I could have got, you know. Yeah. And I cannot say what I really want to say, that it is more, it's much more than I had expected. Okay. Soon, word spreads in the region. I'm the only one from the entire region who has been admitted to Alliance High School that year. But slowly, ever so slowly, I make peace with my fate, especially after the headmaster congratulates me and tells me that Alliance High School is the best high school in the country, that it admits only the really best. Before he gives me the package containing information about tuition, clothes, and other items. And then the brute reality. My mother cannot afford tuition, and everybody knows it. And the brother who would have been in a position to help is now in the mountains. Rumors start that the rich and the loyalist would surely petition the government to prevent the brother of a Mau Mau guerrilla from going to such a prestigious high school. I really don't know how to take the rumors, which are only adding to my uncertainty. Why would anyone want to gamble against me when I have worked so hard to get this far? I recall all the days and nights when I had read or done my homework in flickering firelight. The nights I could not read because we had run out of firewood and paraffin. But donations came in here and there, from here and there, and eventually I have the required initial payment, but not enough for a whole year. This is fine for the time being. We shall cross the other bridges when we come to them. I have a new set of clothes and a wooden box. I've got everything I need, well, almost everything. A pair of shoes and long stocking or socks are among the requirements, and I cannot afford the money for them. You see, one can ask donations for big things like tuition. Education has always been seen as a personal and communal ideal, but money for shoes and stocks? I had never owned or worn a pair in my life, except once when I tried on my elder brother's shoes and trousers, all bigger than my size, and he caught me strutting about in a yard, my younger brother crying for his turn. But after I was admonished rather harshly, my brother now turned around and laughed at me. Otherwise, I'd walked barefoot all my life. The expectation of wearing shoes for the first time was as intense as that other time long ago when my mother bought me my first shirt and shorts for my primary school. A pair of shoes now stands between me and high school. My sister Yoki comes to the rescue. Yoki is the quietest in my mother's house. She broods a lot. Life has not treated her well. There was a time when she was in love with a tractor driver from Geisha. He was part of the workforce in the construction of a tunnel, a Elimru tunnel under the land owned by a Mr. Buxton, one of the soldiers who settled in the area after the First World War. Before the tunnel, the train took a long time to go round the hill. The digging of the tunnel after the Second World War had created all sorts of rumors that the whites were interfering with the order of nature, that they were planning something sinister for Africans. Otherwise, why was the whole thing so secret? Still, there was a certain prestige conferred on those who worked on the project, especially the drivers. My sister was happy when her tractor driver visited our place and talked of the dynamite used to break up the rocks. He talked of the dangers he faced daily and even said that some people had been killed by the rocks and the dynamite. The danger he toiled under and his bravery captivated the jockey even more. She was so much more alive. She used to laugh and dance, but her love did not meet the approval of my brother. He and his friends dissuaded her from the wedding of her choice. She instead married a wealthy suitor who owned a truck and had a contract to supply Maram for road repair. The marriage had grown sour and ended in divorce. She had lost her first love. She lost her first love, the tractor driver in the process. News of his death and a falling rock in the tunnel, together with her failed marriage, took the joy of life from her. Laughter left her. She earned money, not much, by working in the tea plantations across the rail or in the Paradigm fields owned by an African landlord. Now, she gives up all she has to buy me the required pair of shoes and socks. I am moved by this. Instead of saying thank you, I tell her that I'm really very sorry for the day I once chased her through the Paradigm field with a chameleon on a stick. Like many others in the area, she was mortally afraid of chameleons. I had always felt guilty about the incident, but she obviously has forgotten all about it, and it takes some seconds for her to understand what I'm talking about. And then she breaks into laughter, a big bellyful of laughter. It's so wonderful to see her smile, to see the gloom disappear from her face, to see how beautiful she really is. And whenever I wear shoes, I know I shall always recall that smile and that laughter. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that reading. It looks like we've got about 10, 15 minutes for questions. So if you'd like to raise your hand, we will call on you. I will call on you. Please wait for the microphone. Lamont?
Thank you. I'm Professor Ngugi. Hello. Welcome to Philadelphia.
Hi. Nice meeting you.
Could you offer a comment about the recent loss of South African poet Dennis Brutus?
Sorry, about the loss? Yeah, Dennis Brutus. In fact, I had him very much in my mind because as you know, he worked here for many, many years in Penn State, you know, in Pittsburgh University. But as you know, he was very, very active he was everything. Anyway, I've just written a piece called My Hero for The Guardian in London, in which I tell my relationship with Dennis. But I'll tell you a little bit about it, just, you know, because it's very, very important. I first met Dennis Bruta as an absence in 1962. What do I mean by that? There was a conference of African writers in Kampala in 1962, attended by most of the African writers then, and also writers from here like Langston Hughes and Saunders Redding, who was a very important critic here. So it was a very big con. But Brutus had just published Prison Poems, Sirens, Boots, and Knuckles, and so on. And this small volume dominated discussion at the conference. So his absence was a very big presence in 1962 when I was beginning to write. Later, I met him second time in person, this time in 1966 or 69 at another conference, Afro-Scandinavian Writers Conference. And this time he was there in person. He had escaped from South Africa. He was now living in London and so on. And so we traveled together from Oslo to London. And I saw something amazing. I mean, I always remember this of Dennis. We sat next to each other, talking, you know, about himself, about myself, in just exchanging. And he was following every question and responding to it. But Dennis was also, at the same time, was opening letters, reading them, answering them, folding them, putting envelopes, and all the time talking to me. Okay, and he was doing so that they would be ready. By the time he got to London, he would post them to the various, you know, activists all over the world. So it was my first experience of what has now come to be known as multitasking. And he was really a multitasking genius, you know, because he was like that all, you know. I've met him several other places, you know, here in Philadelphia, in London, and lastly 2 years ago, actually, in South Africa, in KwaZulu-Land, where I was been invited by another organization, but still, when he knew I was there, he came literally and dragged me to an activist meeting he had, because he said, the youth of this country, they must get to, you cannot come here and they don't hear from you, okay? So he was this kind of a person, you know, multitasking, always focused, but he was not one-sided. When you talk about art, he was very much. In fact, when we were coming from Oslo, we talked about Edvard Munch, one of the Norwegian painters, you know. And wherever he went, I don't know why I came to see him in Pisa, and he went to show me a sculpture of Rodin, you know, the first thing he would think of. Yeah. So he was like that, multitasking, very focused, always very committed. But I tell you this story because it connects to what I read, you know, how you, the first haiku you ever wrote, you saw where in Harlem, and your knees almost buckled, and you sat down overwhelmed by the beauty of this haiku. Let me tell you a haiku story connected to Dennis Brutus, because he also liked to write haikus. Once he and my wife, Jerry, and I were coming from Japan. And those days, Dennis was in, we were trying to expel him from here, you know, or whatever, I can't remember. You know, he was always having problems, you know, at airports, okay? Because his papers were often not always right, you know, and not that they were illegal, but he was always having this because of his history. So, and I had a little history of my own. So we came to Kennedy Airport. And we were stopped, he and I were stopped and put in separate rooms. My wife, being a Kenyan-American, was let through. I was the first to be allowed to come through. So we waited, my wife, and then she got worried now. Huh? As an American, she said, I must storm and go and find out what's happening to Dennis. Go and confront those officials. But on her way, she saw Dennis coming towards her. Now she's thinking, this man must be shaken. You know, this must be awful. But Dennis comes along, and the first thing, holding a piece of paper, and he tells my wife, Jerry, I've just written a haiku. Yeah.
All right. Who's next? Gentleman on the aisle here.
Thank you, Googie, for being here today. I've read most of your books, and especially when I was in University of Nairobi, and I've got a question about the book A Grain of Wheat, about this character Mugo, who appeared to be a hero until at the end of the novel, when he turns to be a villain. Did you create him as a symbol of something during the struggle of independence or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. No, in more of my work, I try to... Particularly, you see this clear in Dreams in a Time of War, where I try to show that some of the things are not always very clear. On looking back, we can see how things were either black or white, or sort of they are contrasted one side or the other. But during a crisis, they are always what you might call gray areas, you know. And that's why I'm even revising sometimes my views, for instance, on... When I was writing this, I had to revise my views on Booker T. Washington when I realized how much, you know, his ideas also had this kind of consequences on my own life in Kenya, because the independent school movements were literally inspired by that notion of self-reliance through Marcus Garvey and Marcus Garvey's connection with Harry Thuku, the early national leader in Kenya in the 1930s and so on. You know, so what I'm trying to say is that sometimes things, when you look back, in the heat of the moment, there are some very gray areas, okay? And things are, in some ways, interconnected. And I try to show this. For instance, my two brothers, I'll tell you this story because I mentioned it here. Once, one is the mountains fighting, okay? The other one is working with the British forces. But they had a third brother, half-brother to them both, who was working in a factory, a Limuru Batashu factory, and he used to live there. So one day, for some reason, both independently decided to go and visit him. But at the gate, just before the gate, because, you know, those houses were, it would have been a compound, and there would be a kind of gate before you enter the compound. It was not completely dark. And they saw each other coming from different directions towards the gate. They never uttered a word, but each turned and ran back where they came from, okay? So these are the kind of, you know, gray areas. And I think some characters like in A Grain of Wheat and the other novels, you know, particularly A Grain of Wheat, I was trying to capture that, you know, complexity, if you like, you know, of a situation where, like that character you mentioned, he was both very, very heroic, but there was something else in his past. And you cannot take one from the other. His heroism may also come from the fact that he was trying to suppress the villain that he was trying to overcome all his life. Yeah.
Looks like we have time for a few more. Lady in, yep, right in the center here, and then we'll go to the gal in blue back there. Could you wait for the mic?
Yes. Hello, Professor Googie. It's a big honor for us to listen to you here. I'm very interested in colonial history and colonization, and you held some very interesting views on language, on use of language, and I wonder what you think about that today. You know, a writer, in what language should he or she express him or herself when the mother tongue is different from the language of the colonizer?
Yeah, I've been very... almost every year, I've become even more convinced about the... but particularly in the case of Africa, the primacy and importance of African languages. This, to me, is very, very important. The You see, language is like the primary, what I call it, I now call it the primary computer, okay, or hardware that contains the primary where you store, is a natural computer where you store knowledge. But you can see the unfairness of, for instance, in the case of many African kids, you know, for instance, they would, say, learn in their language about, say, anatomy, because they come from, they probably have come from families who slaughtered goats and so on, and they would know everything about the anatomy of an animal, and they knew all the parts in their language, only it was not called anatomy, okay? They go to school and told them they're going to have class in anatomy, and this suddenly becomes something totally abstract. Anatomy. Then you have to learn the parts of a goat and so on, use animal anatomy in English and so on, and in books. Okay? So there's no connection often between the knowledge they already have. When it good school, it's not added, the school education is not adding to that. It's suppressing that other knowledge and so on. But we can say that language as a whole is like that. Now, I have, and I said it very clearly, I see nothing wrong with English language or French or any other language. What I've been struggling against is the relationship, the power relationship between languages. Okay, this is what is wrong. Okay, if you know a particular language and you add other languages to it, of course you are more powerful than a monolingual person. Okay? If I grew here, up here, and I spoke Ebonics, for instance, I don't want to think of Ebonics as a lower rank in the ladder of linguistic perfection. I like to think of it as another system, but I would still have to master the language of power, because you need to negotiate your way through school, through commerce, or whatever. But it does not mean that the two are mutually opposed. Okay? You can, in other words, when you learn the language of power, you don't want to be in a position where you think now, when you go back to your village or to your community, when they speak that other language, you think they are speaking wrong English. Okay? Or they are somehow or other, the culture that produced that type of language is somehow lower than the culture of English language and so on. So what I've been talking about is the decolonization of power relationship between languages. You know, you allow mother tongue, whatever it is, even a variant of English or whatever, then you add to it, because the language's power is very, very important. But the more languages you have, the more powerful you have. It's like you have, you think of, language as, think of a room with treasures, you know. Each room has a treasure. Okay? Keys, and to enter that room you have a key. So think of language as a key to treasures in different rooms. The more keys you have, the more you can open the different treasure rooms. If you only one key, you can only open one treasure room. So we need more languages, not less, and we need to really decolonize this power relationship between language. It's not so terrible as getting, you get knowledge or whatever it is, you get your PhD. In the process, you can't be embarrassed by the community you come from. So it's no longer education to make you a master of your environment. It now makes you more of a slave, in the sense that you are now ashamed of where you came from. Okay? It should be the other way around, because the more you know, the more useful you feel to the community. Okay? It should be that kind of relationship. Because the best of a community, in terms of, by the best I mean in terms of, what, no matter how you want to define the best, say in terms of, say, acquisition, sheer acquisition of knowledge, that best is also the best of the community, and the community should be able to have pride in that achievement, and that the person who has achieved should feel pride in the community that he or she came from. That's why I keep on stressing the importance of languages, yeah, particularly the colonizing power relationship between languages.
Okay, and thank you.
Before I finish, I'm not going to read something here, but I just want to really once again stress that there's one theme in this book is that which my mother, who did not know how to read and write, used to tell me, is that the best? Because she was only interested in, did you try your best? Yeah, I know you got 10 out of 10, but is that the best you could have done, you know? Okay? That's, she was interested in, you are trying to do your best. And also, question of a dream, and I want to end by just reading from, which you read in the book itself, anyway, the extract that opens the book. From Martin Carter, from Guyana, you know, about dreams, actually. Only one verse, you know. I have learned from books, dear friend, of men dreaming and living and hungering in a room without a light, who could not die since death was far too poor, who did not sleep to dream, but dreamed to change the world. Thank you.
Yes, thank you to Professor Watthiyongo. Sonia, thanks for your terrific interview, introduction, and thank you all for coming. We'll see you upstairs.
Should we sign books or do you want to sign? Oh, okay.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.